The last straw came a few days later, when my family decided it was time to sell Grandpa Portman's house. Before prospective buyers could be allowed inside, though, the place had to be cleaned out. On the advice of Dr. Golan, who thought it would be good for me to confront the scene of my trauma, I was enlisted to help my dad and Aunt Susie sort through the detritus. For a while after we got to the house, my dad kept taking me aside to make sure I was okay. Surprisingly, I seemed to be, despite the scraps of police tape clinging to the shrubs and the torn screen on the lanai flapping in the breeze. These things, like the rented dumpster that stood on the curb, waiting to swallow what remained of my grandfather's life, made me sad, not scared. Once it became clear I wasn't about to suffer a mouth-frothing freakout, we got down to business. Armed with garbage bags, we proceeded grimly through the house, emptying shelves and cabinets and crawl spaces, discovering geometries of dust beneath objects unmoved for years. We built pyramids of things that could be saved or salvaged, and pyramids of things destined for the dumpster. My aunt and father were not sentimental people, and the dumpster pile was always the largest. I lobbied hard to keep certain things, like the 8-foot stack of water-damaged National Geographic magazines teetering in a corner of the garage. How many afternoons had I spent poring over them, imagining myself among the mud men of New Guinea or discovering a cliff-top castle in the kingdom of Bhutan? But I was always overruled. Neither was I allowed to keep my grandfather's collection of vintage bowling shirts. "They're embarrassing," my dad claimed, his big band and swing 78s. "Someone will pay good money for those." Or the contents of his massive, still-locked weapons cabinet. "You're kidding, right? I hope you're kidding." I told my dad he was being heartless. My aunt fled the scene, leaving us alone in the study, where we'd been sorting through a mountain of old financial records. "I'm just being practical. This is what happens when people die, Jacob." "Yeah? How about when you die? Should I burn all your old manuscripts?" He flushed. I shouldn't have said it. Mentioning his half-finished book projects was definitely below the belt. Instead of yelling at me, though, he was quiet. "I brought you along today because I thought you were mature enough to handle it. I guess I was wrong." "You are wrong. You think getting rid of all Grandpa's stuff will make me forget him, but it won't." He threw up his hands. "You know what? I'm sick of fighting about it. Keep whatever you want." He tossed a sheaf of yellowed papers at my feet. "Here's an itemized schedule of deductions from the year Kennedy was assassinated. Go have it framed." I kicked away the papers and walked out, slamming the door behind me, and then waited in the living room for him to come out and apologize. When I heard the shredder roar to life, I knew he wasn't going to, so I stomped across the house and locked myself in the bedroom. It smelled of stale air and shoe leather and my grandfather's slightly sour cologne. I leaned against the wall, my eyes following a trail worn into the carpet between the door and the bed, where a rectangle of muted sun caught the edge of a box that poked out from beneath the bedspread. I went over and knelt down and pulled it out. It was the old cigar box, enveloped in dust, as if he'd left it there just for me to find. Inside were the photos I knew so well. The invisible boy, the levitating girl, the boulder lifter, the man with a face painted on the back of his head. They were brittle and peeling, smaller than I remembered too. And looking at them now, as an almost adult, it struck me how blatant the fakery was. A little burning and dodging was probably all it took to make the invisible boy's head disappear. The giant rock being hoisted by that suspiciously scrawny kid could have easily been made out of plaster or foam. But these observations were too subtle for a 6-year-old, especially one who wanted to believe. Beneath those photos were 5 more that Grandpa Portman had never shown me. I wondered why, until I looked closer. 3 were so obviously manipulated that even a kid would have seen through them. 1 was a laughable double exposure of a girl trapped in a bottle. Another showed a levitating child suspended by something hidden in the dark doorway behind her. The third was a dog with a boy's face pasted crudely onto it. As if these weren't bizarre enough, the last two were like something out of David Lynch's nightmares. One was an unhappy young contortionist doing a frightening backbend, and the other, a pair of freakish twins were dressed in the weirdest costumes I'd ever seen. Even my grandfather, who'd filled my head with stories of tentacle-tongued monsters, had realized images like these would give any kid bad dreams. Kneeling there on my grandfather's dusty floor with those photos in my hands, I remembered how betrayed I'd felt the day I realized his stories weren't true. Now the truth seemed obvious. His last words had been just another sleight of hand, and his last act was to infect me with nightmares and paranoid delusions that would take years of therapy and metabolism-wrecking medications to rout out. I closed the box and brought it into the living room, where my dad and Aunt Susie were emptying a drawer full of coupons, clipped but never used, into a 10-gallon trash bag. I offered up the box. They didn't ask what was inside. "So that's it," Dr. Golan said. His death was meaningless. I'd been lying on the couch watching a fish tank in the corner, its one golden prisoner swimming in lazy circles. "Unless you've got a better idea," I said. "Some big theory about what it all means that you haven't told me. Otherwise..." "What? Otherwise, this is just a waste of time." He sighed and pinched the bridge of his nose as if trying to dispel a headache. "What your grandfather's last words meant isn't my conclusion to draw," he said. "It's what you think that matters." "That is such psychobabble bullshit," I spat. "It's not what I think that matters, it's what's true. But I guess we'll never know, so who cares? Just dope me up and collect the bill." I wanted him to get mad, to argue, to insist I was wrong. But instead, he sat, poker-faced, drumming the arm of his chair with his pen. "It sounds like you're giving up," he said after a moment. "I'm disappointed. You don't strike me as a quitter." "Then you don't know me very well," I replied. I could not have been less in the mood for a party. I'd known I was in for one the moment my parents began dropping unsubtle hints about how boring and uneventful the upcoming weekend was sure to be, when we all knew perfectly well I was turning 16. I'd begged them to skip the party this year because, among other reasons, I couldn't think of a single person I wanted to invite, but they worried that I spent too much time alone, clinging to the notion that socializing was therapeutic. "So was electroshock," I reminded them, but my mother was loath to pass up even the flimsiest excuse for a celebration. She once invited friends over for our cockatiel's birthday, in part because she loved to show off our house. Wine in hand, she'd heard guests from room to overfurnished room extolling the genius of the architect and telling war stories about the construction. "It took months to get these sconces from Italy." We'd just come home from my disastrous session with Dr. Golan. I was following my dad into our suspiciously dark living room as he muttered things like, "What a shame we didn't plan anything for your birthday," and, "Oh well, there's always next year," when all the lights flooded on to reveal streamers, balloons, and a motley assortment of aunts, uncles, cousins I rarely spoke to, anyone my mother could cajole into attending, and Ricky, whom I was surprised to see lingering near the punch bowl, looking comically out of place in a studded leather jacket. Once everyone had finished cheering, and I had finished pretending to be surprised, my mom slipped her arm around me and whispered, "Is this okay?" I was upset and tired and just wanted to play Warspire 3, The Summoning, before going to bed with the TV on. But what were we going to do? Send everyone home? I said it was fine, and she smiled as if to thank me. "Who wants to see the new addition?" she sang out, pouring herself some Chardonnay before marching a troop of relatives up the stairs. Ricky and I nodded to each other across the room, wordlessly agreeing to tolerate the other's presence for an hour or two. We hadn't spoken since the day he nearly shoved me off the roof, but we both understood the importance of maintaining the illusion of having friends. I was about to go talk to him when my Uncle Bobby grabbed me by the elbow and pulled me into a corner. Bobby was a big barrel-chested guy who drove a big car and lived in a big house and would eventually succumb to a big heart attack from all the foie gras and monster-thick burgers he'd packed into his colon over the years, leaving everything to my pothead cousins and his tiny, quiet wife. He and my Uncle Les were co-presidents of SmartAid, and they were always doing this, pulling people into corners for conspiratorial chats, as if plotting a mob hit rather than complimenting the hostess on her guacamole.
"So your mom tells me you're really turning the corner with, on this whole grandpa thing."
My thing. No one knew what to call it. "Acute stress reaction," I said.
"What?"
That's what I had. Have. Whatever.
"That's good. Real good to hear."
He waved his hand as if putting all that unpleasantness behind us.
"So your mom and I were thinking, how'd you like to come up to Tampa this summer, see how the family business works, crack heads with me at HQ for a while? Unless you love stocking shelves!"
He laughed so loudly that I took an involuntary step backward.
"You could even stay at the house, do a little tarpon fishing with me and your cousins on the weekends."
He then spent 5 long minutes describing his new yacht, going into elaborate, almost pornographic detail, as if that alone were enough to close the deal. When he finished, he grinned and stuck out his hand for me to shake.
"So, what do you think, J-Dog?"
I guess it was designed to be an offer I couldn't refuse, but I'd have rather spent the summer in a Siberian labor camp than live with my uncle and his spoiled kids. As for working at SmartAid HQ, I knew it was a probably inevitable part of my future, but I'd been counting on at least a few more summers of freedom and 4 years of college before I had to lock myself into a corporate cage. I hesitated, trying to think of a graceful way out. Instead, what I said was, "I'm not sure my psychiatrist would think it's such a great idea right now." His bushy eyebrows came together. Nodding vaguely, he said,
"Oh, well, sure. Of course. We'll just play it by ear then, pal. How's that sound?"
And then he walked off without waiting for an answer, pretending to see someone across the room whose elbow he needed to grab. My mother announced that it was time to open presents. She always insisted I do this in front of everyone, which was a problem because, as I may have mentioned already, I'm not a good liar. That also means I'm not good at feigning gratitude for re-gifted CDs of country Christmas music or subscriptions to Field and Stream. For years, Uncle Les had labored under the baffling delusion that I'm outdoorsy. But for decorum's sake, I forced a smile and held up each unwrapped trinket for all to admire until the pile of presents left on the coffee table had shrunk to just 3. I reached for the smallest one first. Inside was a key to my parents' 4-year-old luxury sedan. They were getting a new one, my mom explained, so I was inheriting the old one. My first car. Everyone oohed and ahed, but I felt my face go hot. It was too much like showing off to accept such a lavish present in front of Ricky, whose car cost less than my monthly allowance at age 12. It seemed like my parents were always trying to get me to care about money, but I didn't, really. Then again, it's easy to say you don't care about money when you have plenty of it. The next present was the digital camera I'd begged my parents for all last summer. "Wow," I said, testing its weight in my hand. "This is awesome." "I'm outlining a new bird book," my dad said. "I was thinking maybe you could take the pictures."
"A new book," my mom exclaimed. "That's a phenomenal idea, Frank. Speaking of which, whatever happened to that last book you were working on?"
Clearly, she'd had a few glasses of wine.
"I'm still ironing out a few things," my dad replied quietly.
"Oh, I see,"
I could hear Uncle Bobby snickering. Okay, I said loudly, reaching for the last present. This one's from Aunt Susie. Actually, my aunt said as I began tearing away the wrapping paper, it's from your grandfather. I stopped mid-tear. The room went dead quiet, people looking at Aunt Susie as if she'd invoked the name of some evil spirit. My dad's jaw tensed, and my mom shot back the last of her wine. Just open it and you'll see, Aunt Susie said. I ripped away the rest of the wrapping paper to find an old hardback book, dog-eared and missing its dust jacket. It was The Selected Works of Ralph Waldo Emerson. I stared at it as if trying to read through the cover, unable to comprehend how it had come to occupy my now trembling hands. No one but Dr. Golan knew about the last words, and he'd promised on several occasions that unless I threatened to guzzle Drano or do a backflip off the Sunshine Skyway Bridge, everything we talked about in his office would be held in confidence. I looked at my aunt, a question on my face that I didn't quite know how to ask. She managed a weak smile and said, I found it in your grandfather's desk when we were cleaning out the house. He wrote your name in the front. I think he meant for you to have it. God bless Aunt Susie. She had a heart after all. Neat. I didn't know your grandpa was a reader, my mom said, trying to lighten the mood. That was thoughtful.
Yes, my dad said through clenched teeth. Thank you, Susan.
I opened the book. Sure enough, the title page bore an inscription in my grandfather's shaky handwriting. To Jacob Magellan Portman and the worlds he has yet to discover. I got up to leave, afraid I might start crying in front of everyone, and something slipped out from between the pages and fell to the floor. I bent to pick it up. It was a letter. Emerson. The letter. I felt the blood drain from my face. My mother leaned toward me and in a tense whisper asked if I needed a drink of water, which was mom speak for, keep it together, people are staring. I said, I feel a little, and then, with one hand over my stomach, I bolted to my room. The letter was handwritten on fine, unlined paper in looping script so ornate it was almost calligraphy, the black ink varying in tone like that of an old fountain pen. It read, Dearest Abe, I hope this note finds you safe and in the best of health. It's been such a long time since we last received word from you, but I write not to admonish, only to let you know that we still think of you often and pray for your well-being, our brave, handsome Abe. As for life on the island, little has changed, but quiet and orderly is the way we prefer things. I wonder if we would recognize you after so many years, though I'm certain you'd recognize us, those few who remain, that is. It would mean a great deal to have a recent picture of you, if you've one to send. I've included a positively ancient snap of myself. E misses you terribly. Won't you write to her? With respect and admiration, Headmistress Alma Le Fay Peregrine. As promised, the writer had enclosed an old snapshot. I held it under the glow of my desk lamp, trying to read some detail in the woman's silhouetted face, but there was none to find. The image was so strange, and yet it was nothing like my grandfather's pictures. There were no tricks here. It was just a woman smoking a pipe. It looked like Sherlock Holmes's pipe, curved and drooping from her lips. My eyes kept coming back to it. Was this what my grandfather had meant for me to find? Yes, I thought, it has to be. Not the letters of Emerson, but a letter, tucked inside Emerson's book. But who was this headmistress, this Peregrine woman. I studied the envelope for a return address, but found only a fading postmark that read, Cairnholm Island, Cymru, UK. UK, that was Britain. I knew from studying atlases as a kid that Cymru meant Wales. Cairnholm Island had to be the island Miss Peregrine had mentioned in her letter. Could it have been the same island where my grandfather lived as a boy? 9 months ago, he told me to find the bird. 9 years ago, he had sworn that the children's home where he'd lived was protected by one, by a bird who smoked a pipe. At age 7, I'd taken this statement literally, but the headmistress in the picture was smoking a pipe, and her name was Peregrine, a kind of hawk. What if the bird my grandfather wanted me to find was actually the woman who'd rescued him, the headmistress of the children's home? Maybe she was still on the island, after all these years, old as dirt, but sustained by a few of her wards, children who'd grown up but never left. For the first time, my grandfather's last words began to make a strange kind of sense. He wanted me to go to the island and find this woman, his old headmistress. If anyone knew the secrets of his childhood, it would be her. But the envelope's postmark was 15 years old. Was it possible she was still alive? I did some quick calculations in my head. If she'd been running a children's home in 1939 and was, say, 25 at the time, then she'd be in her late 90s today. So it was possible. There were people older than that in Inglewood who still lived by themselves and drove. And even if Miss Peregrine had passed away in the time since she'd sent the letter, there might still be people on Cairnholm who could help me, people who had known Grandpa Portman as a kid, people who knew his secrets. We, she had written, those few who remain. As you can imagine, convincing my parents to let me spend part of my summer on a tiny island off the coast of Wales was no easy task. They, particularly my mother, had many compelling reasons why this was a wretched idea, including the cost, the fact that I was supposed to spend the summer with Uncle Bobby learning how to run a drug empire, and that I had no one to accompany me, since neither of my parents had any interest in going, and I certainly couldn't go alone. I had no effective rebuttals, and my reason for wanting to make the trip, I think I'm supposed to, wasn't something I could explain without sounding even crazier than they already feared I was. I certainly wasn't going to tell my parents about Grandpa Portman's last words, or the letter, or the photo. They would have had me committed. The only sane-sounding arguments I could come up with were things like, I want to learn more about our family history, and the never-persuasive, Chad Kramer and Josh Bell are going to Europe this summer, why can't I? I brought these up as frequently as possible without seeming desperate, even once resorting to, it's not like you don't have the money, a tactic I instantly regretted, but it looked like it wasn't going to happen. Then, several things happened that helped my case enormously. First, Uncle Bobby got cold feet about my spending the summer with him, because who wants a nutcase living in their house? So my schedule was suddenly wide open. Next, my dad learned that Cairnholm Island is a super important bird habitat, and, like half the world's population of some bird that gives him a total ornithology boner lives there. He started talking a lot about his hypothetical new bird book, and whenever the subject came up, I did my best to encourage him and sound interested. But the most important factor was Dr. Golan. After a surprisingly minimal amount of coaxing by me, he shocked us all by not only signing off on the idea, but also encouraging my parents to let me go. It could be important for him, he told my mother after a session one afternoon. It's a place that's been so mythologized by his grandfather that visiting could only serve to demystify it. He'll see that it's just as normal and unmagical as any place else, and by extension, his grandfather's fantasies will lose their power. It could be a highly effective way of combating fantasy with reality.
But I thought he already didn't believe that stuff, my mother said, turning to me. Do you, Jake?
I don't, I assured her. Not consciously, he doesn't, Dr. Golan said. But it's his unconscious that's causing him problems right now. The dreams, the anxiety.
And you really think going there could help? My mother said, narrowing her eyes at him as if readying herself to hear the unvarnished truth. When it came to things I should or should not be doing, Dr. Golan's word was law.
I do, he replied. And that was all it took.
After that, things fell into place with astonishing speed. Plane tickets were bought, schedules scheduled, plans laid. My dad and I would go for 3 weeks in June. I wondered if that was too long, but he claimed he needed at least that much time to make a thorough study of the island's bird colonies. I thought Mom would object. 3 whole weeks. But the closer our trip got, the more excited for us she seemed. My two men, she would say, beaming, off on a big adventure. I found her enthusiasm kind of touching, actually, until the afternoon I overheard her talking on the phone to a friend, venting about how relieved she'd be to have her life back for 3 weeks and not have 2 needy children to worry about. I love you too, I wanted to say with as much hurtful sarcasm as I could muster, but she hadn't seen me, and I kept quiet. I did love her, of course, but mostly just because loving your mom is mandatory, not because she was someone I think I'd like very much if I met her walking down the street. Which she wouldn't be, anyway. Walking is for poor people. During the 3 week window between the end of school and the start of our trip, I did my best to verify that Ms. Alma LaFay Peregrine still resided among the living, but internet searches turned up nothing. Assuming she was still alive, I had hoped to get her on the phone and at least warn her that I was coming, but I soon discovered that almost no one on Cairnholm even had a phone. I found only one number for the entire island, so that's the one I dialed. It took nearly a minute to connect, the line hissing and clicking, going quiet, then hissing again, so that I could feel every mile of the vast distance my call was spanning. Finally, I heard that strange European ring, wop, 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 and a man whom I could only assume was profoundly intoxicated answered the phone.
Pisshole,
he bellowed. There was an unholy amount of noise in the background, the kind of dull roar you'd expect at the height of a raging frat party. I tried to identify myself, but I don't think he could hear me.
Pisshole,
he bellowed again.
Who's this now?
But before I could say anything, he'd pulled the receiver away from his head to shout at someone.
I said shut up, you dozy bastards! I'm on the...
And then the line went dead. I sat with the receiver to my ear for a long, puzzled moment, then hung up. I didn't bother calling back. If Cairnholm's only phone connected to some den of iniquity called the piss hole, how did that bode for the rest of the island? Would my first trip to Europe be spent evading drunken maniacs and watching birds evacuate their bowels on rocky beaches? Maybe so, but if it meant that I'd finally be able to put my grandfather's mystery to rest and get on with my unextraordinary life, anything I had to endure would be worth it. Chapter 3. Fog closed around us like a blindfold. When the captain announced that we were nearly there, at first I thought he was kidding. All I could see from the ferry's rolling deck was an endless curtain of gray. I clutched the rail and stared into the green waves, contemplating the fish who might be soon enjoying my breakfast, while my father stood shivering beside me in shirt sleeves. It was colder and wetter than I'd ever known June could be. I hoped, for his sake and mine, that the grueling 36 hours we'd braved to get this far, 3 airplanes,
two layovers, shift napping in grubby train stations, and now this interminable gut-churning ferry ride would pay off. Then my father shouted, "Look!" And I raised my head to see a towering mountain of rock emerge from the blank canvas before us. It was my grandfather's island, looming and bleak, folded in mist, guarded by a million screeching birds. It looked like some ancient fortress constructed by giants. As I gazed up at its sheer cliffs, tops disappearing in a reef of ghostly clouds, the idea that this was a magical place didn't seem so ridiculous. My nausea seemed to vanish. Dad ran around like a kid on Christmas, his eyes glued to the birds wheeling above us.
"Jacob, look at that!" he cried,
pointing to a cluster of airborne specks.
"Manx shearwaters!"
As we drew nearer the cliffs, I began to notice odd shapes lurking underwater. A passing crewman caught me leaning over the rail to stare at them and said,
"Never seen a shipwreck before, eh?"
I turned to him. "Really?"
"This whole area's a nautical graveyard. It's like the old captains used to say. 'Twixt Hotland Point and Cairnholm Bay is a sailor's grave by night or day.'"
Just then we passed a wreck that was so near the surface, the outline of its greening carcass so clear that it looked like it was about to rise out of the water like a zombie from a shallow grave.
"See that one?"
he said, pointing at it.
"Sunk by a U-boat, she was."
"There were U-boats around here?"
"Loads. Whole Irish Sea was rotten with German subs. Wager you'd have half a navy on your hands if you could unsink all the ships they torpedoed."
He arched one eyebrow dramatically, then walked off laughing. I jogged along the deck to the stern, tracking the shipwreck as it disappeared beneath our wake. Then, just as I was starting to wonder if we'd need climbing gear to get onto the island, its steep cliffs sloped down to meet us. We rounded a headland to enter a rocky half-moon bay. In the distance, I saw a little harbor bobbing with colorful fishing boats, and beyond it, a town set into a green bowl of land. A patchwork of sheep-speckled fields spread across hills that rose away to meet a high ridge, where a wall of clouds stood like a cotton parapet. It was dramatic and beautiful, unlike any place I'd seen. I felt a little thrill of adventure as we chugged into the bay, as if I were sighting land where maps had noted only a sweep of undistinguished blue. The ferry docked, and we humped our bags into the little town. Upon closer inspection, I decided it was, like a lot of things, not as pretty up close as it seemed from a distance. Whitewashed cottages, quaint except for the satellite dishes sprouting from their roofs, lined a small grid of muddy gravel streets. Because Cairnholm was too distant and too inconsequential to justify the cost of running power lines from the mainland, foul-smelling diesel generators buzzed on every corner like angry wasps, harmonizing with the growl of tractors, the island's only vehicular traffic. At the edges of town, ancient-looking cottages stood abandoned and roofless, evidence of a shrinking population, children lured away from centuries-old fishing and farming traditions by more glamorous opportunities elsewhere. We dragged our stuff through town, looking for something called the Priest Home, where my dad had booked a room. I pictured an old church converted into a bed and breakfast, nothing fancy, just somewhere to sleep when we weren't watching birds or chasing down leads. We asked a few locals for directions, but got only confused looks in return. "They speak English, right?" my dad wondered aloud. Just as my hand was beginning to ache from the unreasonable weight of my suitcase, we came upon a church. We thought we'd found our accommodations until we went inside and saw that it had indeed been converted, but into a dingy little museum, not a B&B. We found the part-time curator in a room hung with old fishing nets and sheep shears. His face lit up when he saw us, then fell when he realized we were only lost.
"I reckon you're after the priest hole,"
he said. It's got the only rooms to let on the island. He proceeded to give us directions in a lilting accent, which I found enormously entertaining. I loved hearing Welsh people talk, even if half of what they said was incomprehensible to me. My dad thanked the man and turned to go, but he'd been so helpful, I hung back to ask him another question. Where can we find the old children's home? The old what? He said, squinting at me. For an awful moment, I was afraid we'd come to the wrong island, or, worse yet, that the home was just another thing my grandfather had invented. It was a home for refugee kids, I said. During the war, a big house. The man chewed his lip and regarded me doubtfully, as if deciding whether to help or to wash his hands of the whole thing. But he took pity on me. I don't know about any refugees, he said, but I think I know the place you mean. It's way up on the other side of the island, past the bog and through the woods. Though I wouldn't go mucking about up there alone if I was you. Stray too far from the path, and that's the last anyone'll hear of you. Nothing but wet grass and sheep paddies to keep you from going straight over a cliff.
That's good to know, my dad said, eyeing me. Promise me you won't go by yourself.
All right, all right. What's your interest in it anyhow? The man said. It's not exactly on the tourist maps.
Just a little genealogy project, my father replied, lingering near the door. My dad spent a few years there as a kid.
I could tell he was eager to avoid any mention of psychiatrists or dead grandfathers. He thanked the man again and quickly ushered me out the door. Following the curator's directions, we retraced our steps until we came to a grim-looking statue carved from black stone, a memorial called The Waiting Woman, dedicated to islanders lost at sea. She wore a pitiful expression and stood with arms outstretched in the direction of the harbor, many blocks away, but also toward the priest hole, which was directly across the street. Now, I'm no hotel connoisseur, but one glance at the weathered sign told me that our stay was unlikely to be a 4-star mince on your pillow type experience. Printed in giant script at the top was wines, ales, spirits. Below that, in more modest lettering, fine food. Handwritten along the bottom, clearly an afterthought, was rooms to let, though the S had been struck out, leaving just the singular room. As we lugged our bags toward the door, my father grumbling about con men and false advertising, I glanced back at the waiting woman and wondered if she wasn't just waiting for someone to bring her a drink. We squeezed our bags through the doorway and stood blinking in the sudden gloom of a low-ceilinged pub. When my eyes had adjusted, I realized that hole was a pretty accurate description of the place. Tiny leaded windows admitted just enough light to find the beer tap without tripping over tables and chairs on the way. The tables, worn and wobbling, looked like they might be more useful as firewood. The bar was half-filled, at whatever hour of the morning it was, with men in various states of hushed intoxication, heads bowed prayerfully over tumblers of amber liquid.
"You must be after the room," said the man behind the bar, coming out to shake our hands. "I'm Kev, and these are the fellas. Say hello, fellas."
"Hello,"
they muttered, nodding at their drinks. We followed Kev up a narrow staircase to a suite of rooms, plural, that could charitably be described as basic. There were two bedrooms, the larger of which Dad claimed, and a room that tripled as a kitchen, dining room, and living room, meaning that it contained one table, one moth-eaten sofa, and one hot plate. The bathroom worked most of the time, according to Kev,
but if it ever gets dicey, there's always Old Reliable.
He directed our attention to a portable toilet in the alley out back, conveniently visible from my bedroom window.
"Oh, and you'll need these," he said,
fetching a pair of oil lamps from a cabinet.
"The generators stopped running at 10 since petrol's so bloody expensive to ship out, so either you get to bed early, or you learn to love candles and kerosene. He grinned. Hope it ain't too medieval for you.
We assured Kev that outhouses and kerosene would be just fine. Sounded like fun, in fact. A little adventure, yes sir. And then he led us downstairs for the final leg of our tour.
You're welcome to take your meals here, he said, and I expect you will, on account of there's nowhere else to eat. If you need to make a call, we got a phone box in the corner there. Sometimes there's a bit of a queue for it, though since we get doodly for mobile reception out here, and you're looking at the only landline on the island. That's right, we got it all. Only food, only bed, only phone.
And he leaned back and laughed, long and loud. The only phone on the island. I looked over at it. It was the kind that had a door you could pull shut for privacy, like the ones you see in old movies, and realized with dawning horror that this was the Grecian orgy. This was the raging frat party I'd been connected to when I called the island a few weeks ago. This was the piss hole. Kev handed my dad the keys to our rooms.
Any questions? He said. You know where to find me.
I have a question, I said. What's a piss? I mean, a priest hole? The men at the bar burst into laughter.
Why, it's a hole for priests, of course,
one said, which made the rest of them laugh even harder. Kev walked over to an uneven patch of floorboards next to the fireplace where a mangy dog lay sleeping.
Right here,
he said, tapping what appeared to be a door in the floor with his shoe.
Ages ago, when just being a Catholic could get you hung from a tree, clergy folk came here seeking refuge. If Queen Elizabeth's crew of thugs come chasing after, we hid whoever needed hiding in snug little spots like this, priest holes.
It struck me the way he said, we, as if he'd known those long-dead islanders personally.
Snug indeed,
one of the drinkers said.
But they were warm as toast and tight as drums down there.
I'd take warm and snug to strung up by priest killers any day, said another.
Hear, hear,
the first man said.
Took Cairn home. May she always be our rock of refuge. To Cairn home,
they chorused, and raised their glasses together. Jet-lagged and exhausted, we went to sleep early. Or rather, we went to our beds and lay in them with pillows covering our heads to block out the thumping cacophony that issued through the floorboards, which grew so loud that at one point I thought surely the revelers had invaded my room. Then the clock must have struck 10, because all at once the buzzing generators outside sputtered and died, as did the music from downstairs and the streetlight that had been shining through my window. Suddenly, I was cocooned in silent, blissful darkness, with only the whisper of distant waves to remind me where I was. For the first time in months, I fell into a deep, nightmare-free slumber. I dreamed instead about my grandfather as a boy, about his first night here, a stranger in a strange land, under a strange roof, owing his life to people who spoke a strange tongue. When I awoke, sun streaming through my window, I realized it wasn't just my grandfather's life that Miss Peregrine had saved, but mine, too, and my father's. Today, with any luck, I would finally get to thank her. I went downstairs to find my dad already bellied up to a table, slurping coffee and polishing his fancy binoculars. Just as I sat down, Kev appeared bearing two plates loaded with mystery meat and fried toast.
I didn't know you could fry toast,
I remarked, to which Kev replied that there wasn't a food he was aware of that couldn't be improved by frying. Over breakfast, Dad and I discussed our plan for the day. It was to be a kind of scout, to familiarize ourselves with the island. We'd scope out my dad's bird-watching spots first, and then find the children's home. I scarfed my food, anxious to get started. Well fortified with grease, we left the pub and walked through town, dodging tractors and shouting to each other over the din of generators until the streets gave way to fields and the noise faded behind us. It was a crisp and blustery day, the sun hiding behind giant cloud banks only to burst out moments later and dapple the hills with spectacular rays of light, and I felt energized and hopeful. We were heading for a rocky beach where my dad had spotted a bunch of birds from the ferry. I wasn't sure how we would reach it, though. The island was slightly bowl-shaped, with hills that climbed toward its edges only to drop off at precarious seaside cliffs. But at this particular spot, the edge had been rounded off, and a path led down to a minor spit of sand along the water. We picked our way down to the beach, where what seemed to be an entire civilization of birds were flapping and screeching and fishing in tide pools. I watched my father's eyes widen. "Fascinating," he muttered, scraping at some petrified guano with the stubby end of his pen. "I'm going to need some time here. Is that all right?" I'd seen this look on his face before, and I knew exactly what "some time" meant. Hours and hours. "Then I'll go find the house by myself," I said.
"Not alone, you aren't. You promised."
"Then I'll find a person who can take me."
"Who?"
"Kev will know someone." My dad looked out to sea, where a big rusted lighthouse jutted up from a pile of rocks.
"You know what the answer would be if your mom were here," he said.
My parents had differing theories about how much parenting I required. Mom was the enforcer, always hovering, but Dad hung back a little. He thought it was important that I make my own mistakes now and then. Also, letting me go would free him to play with guano all day.
"Okay," he said, "but make sure you leave me the number of whoever you go with."
"Dad, nobody here has phones," he sighed.
"Right. Well, as long as they're reliable."
Kev was out running an errand, and because asking one of his drunken regulars to chaperone me seemed like a bad idea, I went into the nearest shop to ask someone who was at least gainfully employed. The door read, "Fishmonger." I pushed it open to find myself cowering before a bearded giant in a blood-soaked apron. He left off decapitating fish to glare at me, dripping cleaver in hand, and I vowed never again to discriminate against the intoxicated.
"What the hell for?"
he growled when I told him where I wanted to go.
"Nothing over there but bog land and balmy weather."
I explained about my grandfather and the children's home. He frowned at me, then leaned over the counter to cast a doubtful glance at my shoes.
"I suppose Dylan ain't too busy to take you,"
he said, pointing his cleaver at a kid about my age who was arranging fish in a freezer case.
"But you'll be wanting proper footwear. Wouldn't do to let you go in them trainers. Mud'll suck 'em right off."
"Really?" I said. "Are you sure?"
"Dylan, fetch our man here a pair of Wellingtons."
The kid groaned and made a big show of slowly closing the freezer case and cleaning his hands before slouching over to a wall of shelves packed with dry goods.
"Just so happens we've got some good sturdy boots on offer,"
the fishmonger said.
"Buy one, get none free."
He burst out laughing and slammed his cleaver on a salmon, its head shooting across the blood-slick counter to land perfectly in a little guillotine bucket. I fished the emergency money Dad had given me from my pocket, figuring that a little extortion was a small price to pay to find the woman I'd crossed the Atlantic to meet. I left the shop wearing a pair of rubber boots so large my sneakers fit inside, and so heavy it was difficult to keep up with my begrudging guide. "So, do you go to school on the island?" I asked Dylan, scurrying to catch up. I was genuinely curious. What was living here like for someone my age? He muttered the name of a town on the mainland. "What is that, an hour each way by ferry?"
"Yup."
And that was it. He responded to further attempts at conversation with even fewer syllables, which is to say, none. So finally, I just gave up and followed him. On the way out of town, we ran into one of his friends, an older boy wearing a blinding yellow tracksuit and fake gold chains. He couldn't have looked more out of place on Cairnholm if he'd been dressed like an astronaut. He gave Dylan a fist bump and introduced himself as Worm.
Worm?
It's his stage name, Dylan explained.
We're the sickest rapping duo in Wales, Worm said. I'm MC Worm, and this is the Sturgeon Surgeon, a.k.a. MC Dirty Dylan, a.k.a. MC Dirty Business, Cairnholm's number one beatboxer. Want to show this yank how we do it, Dirty D?
Dylan looked annoyed.
Now,
drop some next-level beats, son.
Dylan rolled his eyes, but did as he was asked. At first, I thought he was choking on his tongue, except there was a rhythm to his sputtering coughs.
Puh-puh-cha, puh-puh-puh-cha,
over which Worm began to rap.
I likes to get wrecked up and down at the priest hole. Your dad's always there 'cause he's on the dole. My rhymes is tight, yet I make it look easy. Dylan's beats are hot like chicken Jalfrezi.
Dylan stopped.
That don't even make sense, he said.
And it's your dad who's on the dole. Oh, shit! Dirty D, let the beat drop!
Worm started beatboxing while doing a passable robot, his sneakers twisting holes in the gravel.
Take the mic, D!
Dylan seemed embarrassed, but let the rhymes fly anyway.
I met a tight bird and her name was Sharon. She was keen on my tracksuit and the trainers I was wearing. I showed her the time like Doctor Who. I thunk up this rhyme while I was in the loo.
Worm shook his head.
The loo? I wasn't ready.
They turned to me and asked what I thought. Considering that they didn't even like each other's rapping, I wasn't sure what to say. I guess I'm more into music with, like, singing and guitars and stuff. Worm dismissed me with a wave of his hand.
He wouldn't know a dope rhyme if it bit him in the bollocks, he muttered.
Dylan laughed, and they exchanged a series of complex, multi-stage handshake fist bump high fives. Can we go now? I said. They grumbled and dawdled a while longer, but pretty soon we were on our way, this time with Worm tagging along. I took up the rear, trying to figure out what I would say to Miss Peregrine when I met her. I was expecting to be introduced to a proper Welsh lady and sip tea in the parlor and make polite small talk until the time seemed right to break the bad news. I'm Abraham Portman's grandson, I would say. I'm sorry to be the one to tell you this, but he's been taken from us. Then, once she'd finished quietly dabbing away tears, I would ply her with questions. I followed Dylan and Worm along a path that wound through pastures of grazing sheep before a lung-busting ascent up a ridge. At the top hovered an embankment of rolling, snaking fog so dense it was like stepping into another world. It was truly biblical. A fog I could imagine God, in one of his lesser wraths, cursing the Egyptians with. As we descended the other side, it only seemed to thicken. The sun faded to a pale white bloom. Moisture clung to everything, beating on my skin and dampening my clothes. The temperature dropped. I lost Worm and Dylan for a moment, and then the path flattened, and I came upon them just standing, waiting for me.
Yank boy, Dylan called. This way.
I followed obediently. We abandoned the path to plow through a field of marshy grass. Sheep stared at us with big, leaky eyes, their wool soggy and tails drooping. A small house appeared out of the mist. It was all boarded up.
You sure this is it? I said. It looks empty.
Empty? No way. There's loads of shit in there, Worm replied. Go on, Dylan said. Have a look.
I had a feeling it was a trick, but stepped up to the door and knocked anyway. It was unlatched and opened a little at my touch. It was too dark to see inside, so I took a step through and, to my surprise, down into what looked like a dirt floor, but I quickly realized was in fact a shin-deep ocean of excrement. This tenantless hovel, so innocent-looking from the outside, was really a makeshift sheep stable. Quite literally, a shithole.
Oh my God!
I squealed in disgust. Peals of laughter exploded from outside. I stumbled backward through the door before the smell could knock me unconscious and found the boys doubled over, holding their stomachs. You guys are assholes, I said, stomping the muck off my boots.
Why? Said Worm. We told you it was full of shit.
I got in Dylan's face. Are you going to show me the house or not?
He's serious,
said Worm, wiping tears from his eyes.
Of course I'm serious.
Dylan's smile faded.
I thought you were taking a piss, mate.
Taking a what?
Joking, like.
Well, I wasn't. The boys exchanged an uneasy look. Dylan whispered something to Worm. Worm whispered something back. Finally, Dylan turned and pointed up the path.
If you really want to see it, he said, keep going past the bog and through the woods. It's a big old place. You can't miss it.
What the hell? You're supposed to go with me. Worm looked away and said,
this is as far as we go.
Why?
It just is.
And they turned and began to trudge back the way we'd come, receding into the fog. I weighed my options. I could tuck tail and follow my tormentors back to town, or I could go ahead alone and lie to Dad about it. After 4 seconds of intense deliberation, I was on my way. A vast lunar bog stretched away into the mist from either side of the path, just brown grass and tea-colored water as far as I could see, featureless, but for the occasional mound of piled-up stones. It ended abruptly at a forest of skeletal trees, branches spindling up like the tips of wet paintbrushes, and for a while, the path became so lost beneath fallen trunks and carpets of ivy that navigating it was a matter of faith. I wondered how an elderly person like Miss Peregrine would ever be able to negotiate such an obstacle course. She must get deliveries, I thought, though the path looked like it hadn't seen a footprint in months, if not years. I scrambled over a giant trunk slick with moss, and the path took a sharp turn. The trees parted like a curtain, and suddenly, there it was, cloaked in fog, looming atop a weed-choked hill. The house. I understood at once why the boys had refused to come. My grandfather had described it 100 times, but in his stories, the house was always a bright, happy place. Big and rambling, yes, but full of light and laughter. What stood before me now was no refuge from monsters, but a monster itself, staring down from its perch on the hill with vacant hunger. Trees burst forth from broken windows, and skins of scabrous vine gnawed at the walls like antibodies attacking a virus, as if nature itself had waged war against it. But the house seemed unkillable, resolutely upright despite the wrongness of its angles and the jagged teeth of sky visible through sections of collapsed roof. I tried to convince myself that it was possible someone could still live there, run down as it was. Such things weren't unheard of where I came from, a falling down wreck on the edge of town, curtains permanently drawn that would turn out to have been home to some ancient recluse who'd been surviving on ramen and toenail clippings since time immemorial, though no one realizes it until a property appraiser or an overly ambitious census taker barges in to find the poor soul returning to dust in a lazy boy. People get too old to care for a place. Their family writes them off for one reason or another. It's sad, but it happens, which meant, like it or not, that I was going to have to knock. I gathered what scrawny courage I had and waded through waist-high weeds to the porch, all broken tile and rotting wood, to peek through a cracked window. All I could make out through the smeared glass were the outlines of furniture, so I knocked on the door.